The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by Valerie Cox, journalist and author, Colm O'Gorman, human rights campaigner, and Gabia Gadavskacha, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, who is all over the front of the Irish Independent with her analysis of the fact that, sorry, I'm my apologies, of the Sunday Independent, with her analysis of the fact that the vast majority of people believe that the housing crisis is getting significantly worse under the current coalition. We will get to that and the results of the Ireland Thinks poll in a minute. Before that, there is good financial news for one person, that being Michael O'Leary, who will no longer have to live on the clippings of tin. He has netted what is one of the biggest corporate bonuses in European history, 100 million quid.
Yeah, he's very careful to make it clear to us, Anton, that he won't get it until 2028, I think, when the share options vest.
I'm sure he'll get a bridging loan in the interim should he need it.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular. I did think he's when I say defence, rather, but part of his reaction to criticism of him receiving this money was to say that, I quote, "I think we're delivering exceptional value for Ryanair shareholders in an area where premiership footballers and managers are getting paid 20 to 25 million a year." So in other words, these other wildly overpaid people are getting paid this much. So actually, I think we're pretty good value in comparison. I thought that was a great...
I suppose a bit like the Premiership footballers, to some extent, though, he is on a performance bonus in that this was linked to the share price had to perform to a certain degree for a certain duration, which it has, and he's now got 100 million.
And not to get too wonky about it, but I think there has been some critique of that approach from some consultants who have pointed out that share buyback schemes to buy back 750 million worth of shares would have inflated the cost of the shares and therefore that this was something that could have been manipulated. I don't understand these things, but in and of itself, it seems a little bit dubious.
I think that we may be counting his chickens before they're hatched, because he said himself, "I and the rest of the management team have to stay here till 2028. So anything could happen between now and 2028. I would not be that happy if I was Michael O'Leary. I don't think he's guaranteed this money at all.
I don't think Michael O'Leary is going to go anywhere before 2028 in order to get hold of his 100 million. But look, I mean, on some level, it's going to sound terribly begrudging, and I don't mean it in that way. But frankly, let's be honest. I mean, on another side of the conversation today, we'll be talking about the housing crisis. There's something frankly obscene about the fact that individuals can amass this much wealth in a world where we're seeing, you know, just rising inequality and the impact of that.
That's funny. That's exactly the
and
that
then equally,
adjective.
And then equally the level of social division that I think has been driven by people's experience of that level of inequality.
We don't see Michael O'Leary flash much of his wealth, though, do we?
No.
Really? I mean, he flies on the Ryanair flights. Yeah. I'm sure he does fly private at times, but... like, he has kind of become the king of media and catchphrases and putting out a great phrase. And he knows how to make the headlines. He really understands
how
the media works.
He does, obviously.
And if you look at the last government, I mean, he gave the Green Party an awful time. And you know, he probably was very mean and if not even bullied Eamon Ryan in some way and Catherine Martin as well.
He did the same with Mary O'Rourke, I seem to remember, yeah.
So, like, he doesn't pull his punches at all. And I think that's probably where that 100 million performance bonus comes from, is how effective he is at making the headlines. And when he says some stuff, because he says it in such, it's Trumpian in the way that it's very simple, clear, plain language. So your average listener, your average reader can understand it. You know, he'll say, "We shouldn't be having people drinking two more than 2 pints in the airport because then they're blotto on the plane." Like, everyone understands that.
And that's what makes here's a litre of vodka for 15 quid whilst you're on the plane, because that's got nothing to do. Like, I mean, to be clear, Ryanair have transformed global aviation.
And
I can remember
extraordinary success story.
And it's a huge success story, and all credit to them for that. I remember living in London moving to London in the mid 1980s, and then you would pay £500 sterling for a return flight to Dublin if it was getting any close to busy times. Right? I mean, they've opened up. The climate issues aside for a moment, they've opened up aviation in a way that's just been quite extraordinary. And he has been an incredibly successful and impactful.
And built one of the most significant companies in Irish corporate history. But Tech saying the Michael O'Leary bonus is obscene. He is undoubtedly a gifted businessman, but he alone did not achieve the recent success on his Todd. A shared bonus amongst all staff would be so much better. Glorifying such greed is also obscene. Well, we will stop on that basis. 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087-1400-106. I mentioned Gabia's story on the front of the Sunday Independent, that being the number of people who believe that the housing crisis is getting significantly worse under the coalition seems to be broad consensus. 80+% of people, I think, could be saying it's much worse now than it was.
So 61% of the public believe the housing crisis has gotten worse in the lifetime of the coalition, and only 3% believe there's been any improvement in housing, 34% saying it stayed the same. And of course, Housing Minister James Brown this week, he conceded, look, we're going to miss the targets again this year. 41,000 new homes. He's saying it's going to be very, very difficult, an extreme climb to reach. ESRI thinks we're going to maybe build about 34,000 homes this year and 37,000 next year. But when you actually drill into the data that was pulled by Kevin Cunningham of Ireland Thinks, it's very interesting. It shows that there's even a shortage of confidence between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael supporters. 30% Fianna Fáil supporters feel the housing crisis has gotten worse, and 27% Fine Gael supporters think the same. So when you drill into who was answering the question, really quite remarkable. Now, of course, when you look at some of the opposition parties, 91% of Sinn Féin voters think the housing crisis is worse. And we're waiting for this housing czar to be appointed. There was an expectation that it could happen in the coming days, because we have a cabinet subcommittee on housing on Thursday. And if your listeners cast their minds back to when the Brendan McDonagh controversy erupted, that was when the last meeting of that committee was basically the proverbial hit the fan, and he couldn't get Brendan McDonagh's name through because Fine Gael effectively blocked it. So there was an expectation that he would bring a list of names to the cabinet subcommittee as to who would populate that housing activation office. That, my understanding, is increasingly unlikely now.
And that housing activation office is getting a lot of attention because there is a suggestion that it is a large part of what the Mail on Sunday is suggesting is the reason that the minister has lost authority. They quote Graham Doyle, the Sec-Gen in that department, as saying, there's a sense in some quarters that if you knock a few heads together, if you give people a kick in the backside, then things happen. I only wish this was the case. And the reaction was that a number of government sources have been critical of what he has said. And he has come out to clarify by saying that he is fully supportive of the Housing Activation Office and wholly supportive of the minister and what he's trying to achieve in this regard. Interesting phraseology for support, isn't it?
Yeah, but at the same time, he's still saying there's no need for a housing czar. But I think James Brown, the housing minister, he's in a difficult position now, because I think he feels that he's losing control of the department. And he had to say the other day, I am in charge of this brief. Let me be clear. Policy decisions are made by the minister. I lead, decide, and I am held to account for that. So it's almost like he's trying to swim back to a position where people are listening to him and not listening maybe to people like the Secretary General in relation to the housing czar. But, you know, it muddies the area entirely, and people don't know which way they should be going. If James Brown can't hold on to this, it's going to make him a very ineffectual minister and is going to confuse issues even further. I think he needs to, you know, hold his nerve, exert his authority and give confidence to the role. Because at the moment, I mean, look at those figures. 61% say housing has been worse in the lifetime of the coalition. So I think he's going to have to, you know, hold his nerve and be a stronger minister than he is at the moment.
To be honest, I'm surprised that it's only 61%. Mm. I mean, as a matter of objective fact, it's gotten worse, right? We had record housing homelessness figures again coming out just this week. The minister's made it clear they're not going to hit their housing targets again this year. Objectively, it's obvious that the crisis has gotten worse and we're beyond a crisis. My worry would be that we're now going to end up in this space where it becomes about personality and politics rather than about delivery. So we'll end up talking about the politics of the situation, which I understand, rather than looking at how do we solve the housing crisis. And I'd be really concerned that we're maybe getting to a stage where, a bit like health a number of years ago, we just had an ongoing, everybody accepted that our health system was in chaos and that it was never going to work.
Perma-crisis.
Are we going to end up in a state now where the perma-crisis just becomes our reality and Ireland is just an awful place from a housing perspective? That's really, really worrying.
Sure, hasn't that been the case for years and years already?
Yeah, but I mean, we're not getting, I mean, there was interesting stuff during the week about, for instance, the capacity within the construction industry to actually build housing. I mean, you had the Cooperative Society up in Donegal saying that they were having to shelve
a significant number of projects because they simply didn't have the skills, the skills tradespeople to carry out the work. You know, you had the head of the co-op saying that the lack of tradespeople in construction should be declared a national emergency because it's a national emergency. Or another senior project manager in another construction company saying that Irish construction workers under the age of 30 have become a rare breed. Mm. There's a huge skills gap here. And we're not really getting to grips with that. And at the same time, in the political narrative, you have housing is a huge issue. There's lots of concern around immigration and we have massive skill shortages. Mm. And the only way we're going to resolve the skill shortages of construction is if we bring in skills tradespeople. But we don't seem to be getting to grips with that at all. Like our work permit system, for instance, isn't actually attractive for skilled tradespeople to come to Ireland at all because of the kind of work permit that they'd have to secure in order to come here. They can't bring their families with them, for instance. There's no prospect
of
that.
But I think there is actually a huge interest now in following these trades. The figures at the moment, I mean, there's been thousands of applications of kids who want to go into apprenticeships rather than, say, a college after the leaving.
The problem there, Valerie, is that the apprenticeship program, which is brilliant, has now become very broad and there are apprenticeships across lots of areas. There actually hasn't been a huge increase in the number of people going into construction trades. The other difficulty is it'll take a number of years before those tradespeople come on train and can start to deliver. Mm-hmm. We need skilled tradespeople to ramp up construction capacity now, not in 3 years' time.
But in conjunction with that, then, we've also got the problem of the utilities not being available. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the number of housing estates on hold at the moment, I think it's something like 17, simply because they cannot get water into these areas and there isn't sufficient water. So, I mean, what do you do in that situation?
We're going to be talking to Ona Brin, the Sinn Féin housing spokesperson, just after 11. We'll get his take on all of these matters. Just on Michael O'Leary. Huge amount of people who are big Michael O'Leary fans. Would they ever give over, says a text. Ryanair is a hugely successful international company and Michael O'Leary has worked incredibly hard over the past 3 decades to make it so. That he has been incredibly well rewarded for doing so is between himself and the board, who are clearly happy with the huge progress that has been made from its humble origins in Waterford with one flight back in the 1980s. And another pointing out, reminder to begrudgers and whingers, Michael O'Leary is an Irish tax resident and is likely to pay 50% plus of that 100 million euro to revenue, so it's positive for Ireland.
Two things on that. First of all, I think we were all effusive in our acknowledgement of Michael O'Leary's success in his role. And secondly, if Michael O'Leary is using any kind of proper wealth management, I can guarantee you he won't be paying 50 million of that 100 million euros in tax. Whether he should or not is a whole different thing. I think he should, but I very much doubt he'll be doing that. We shouldn't make this personality based either. I think our overall comment was about the fact that this level of wealth being amassed by any individual is...
Valerie's dander is up, though.
I'm just thinking, you know, what would this country be like if we didn't have entrepreneurs like Michael O'Leary who are willing to take the risk? I mean, Ryanair could have gone the other way, but you think of the attention he's been given that and the work he's done over the years. Plus, as I said before, he hasn't actually got his hands on the 100 million yet.
I'd say his chances are pretty good.
I'd say they're pretty high.
On that 100 million.
Let's move to more serious matters in the Ireland Thinks poll. There's interesting analysis of Israel and Gaza. And again, given that it's your paper, you might give us some of the numbers because they do show that particularly the Occupied Territories Bill is an interesting one. The Occupied Territories Bill, this being the one that has been pushed by Frances Black for so many years. We were speaking to her yesterday. She believes it is soon to come across the line thanks to the acceptance of Simon Harris. Big support for it.
Yeah, this is in fairness quite interesting. So respondents were asked, you know, should the Occupied Territories Bill, which seeks to prevent Ireland from trading in goods and services imported from illegally occupied territories, be passed? 74% are saying yes. Really quite an overwhelming result there. You know, should the EU suspend trade with Israel? 76% are saying yes. Only 15% are saying no. Do you believe that Israel's ongoing military action in Gaza amounts to suicide?
To genocide.
Apologies. 86% are saying yes. So, you know, really quite clear the views of the public on that. And I think
that
in
one's
fairness,
very significant, isn't it? 86% of the Irish people believing it's genocide.
Well, in fairness, like that is a word that's being used now by the Taoiseach, by the Taoiseach. And I think we're the first country in the EU to do that. And the Irish viewpoint on what is happening in Gaza, like it is really quite strong when you compare that to of our other EU counterparts, you know, using language that's quite strong. I think really the first real test of the government on this, I mean, we know when Simon Harris took over as Taoiseach, leader Fine Gael, he was very quick to recognise the state of Palestine and everyone thought that was great. But the test now is going to be the Occupied Territories Bill, because, of course, they're not going ahead of Francis Black's legislation. They're coming up with their own version. And if you look at the goods part of it, and what we're hearing now is that the services, you know, it's very tricky to put that into the legislation. So if it just targets the goods, the Financial Times reported in recent weeks that it, from the years 2020-2024, I think Ireland only imported around 600,000 euro worth of goods from the occupied territories. So the question is, really, what is the point of this legislation? If it's going to do, in effect, very little, government will say it's all about sending a message and so on. But like, maybe Ireland has sent the message. Maybe now is the time for actual action.
Yeah, I think it's about more than sending a message, though, right? I think if Ireland, and the reason why Israel are so opposed to this legislation being enacted is because it's precedent setting. I don't think Israel are enormously concerned about the importation of goods or Israel's trade relationship with Ireland, because it's fairly negligible. What they will be deeply concerned about is any other state enacting legislation such as this, because that will, I think, undoubtedly lead to other states beginning to adopt similar legislation, including in the EU context.
At what cost does it come to us?
Well, I think that could be significant. I mean, we know that there'll be significant pressure from the US administration and others, for instance, on Ireland in relation to this legislation. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I mean, I do absolutely recognise that Ireland has been saying some very strong things. Things that are grounded in objective fact, right? And in law, in any reasonable analysis of international humanitarian law, this is a genocide. Israel is perpetrating appalling and ongoing and horrific war crimes in Gaza. It has been for some time. So it's strong because, frankly, the rest of the world, or so much of the rest of the world, seems to be prepared to look the other way and pretend it's not happening and lie about what's happening there. But credit to our political leaders and credit to us as a society.
I mean, the challenge
that we are standing up. I do think, frankly, that Irish society's feelings on this are so strong that it seems to me people are prepared to
and
take
also,
a bit of a hit on that basis.
Well, can I just ask that? Do people understand the nature of the hit? I'm not suggesting this as counterpoint, but the economic, when you talk to a lot of people in the capital markets world, they will say that there is a direct impact in both Israeli capital flowing into Ireland and Irish businesses, and significant American capital so doing, because there is a significant influence of the Israelis on American capital. Are we willing to take that risk?
It seems to me that, I won't speak for everybody, but it seems to me the data suggests that we are, because that has been out there as part of the narrative in relation to this legislation for a long time. When I was in Amnesty International several years ago, we were lobbying and speaking to government about the Occupied Territories Bill then, and that was part of it. It's always been part of the narrative and part of the public discourse that the economic risk of taking a strong position like this would be very significant. And yet what we see in polling is that support for the bill and for that approach has been increased significantly.
Right.
Yeah. It is interesting that the bill is being watered down, though, and removing services, right?
Well, just a point as well to, and we ask this every month in the Ireland Thinks poll for the Sunday Independent, is the biggest issues basically for voters. Like this month, the war in Gaza and Israel, like it's climbed by 12%, so it's at 15% now. So it is something that's even gaining momentum. I will also make the point that, you know, in the context of tariffs and what's going on in the White House, and one day tariffs are happening and the next day they're not, that's really the challenge of bringing through the Occupied Territories Bill legislation or whatever version the government comes up with, because you will have a lot of pressure from the Trump administration. And if Ireland is the first country to, you know, implement it, whenever that may be, Trump may look at it and go, like, what's Ireland doing here and why are you doing this? So, you know, that could really, in the light of tariffs, that could really make life very difficult.
I think it's very important, too, that the voice of Ireland is being heard. And I'm in admiration of Harris and Micheál Martin and the president the other day, who have spoken with such passion about Gaza and what's happening to people there. I mean, they're speaking for all of us. And interestingly enough, I was driving in this morning into News Talk and I was listening to the station, and there was an early morning documentary on about Auschwitz and what happened all of those years ago to people, absolute genocide and how people suffered. And to listen to that and listen to the voices that weren't really that old, and then to compare with this awful suffering we're inflicting as a world, if you like, on people in Gaza today. And I know there's lots of other conflict areas as well. But I mean, you'd nearly just sit and cry because it's so awful and we feel so helpless and we can't do anything. And all of this aid is being held up, can't get in. Some of the aid is actually being held up in Houston in Texas. And the reason for that is, of course, Donald Trump's change in foreign aid policy. But part of it is that he has actually fired the people who know the codes to these warehouses where all the aid is
kept. On that topic, that is a point that Bono made to Joe Rogan on the Joe Rogan Experience, and that has now led to Elon Musk describing him, Bono, as both a liar and an idiot. We'll get to that after this break. On the topic of apprenticeships, which we were discussing earlier on, we're being asked to celebrate that Ireland has the highest... This is a text. We're being asked to celebrate that Ireland has the highest percentage of population getting third level education while we do not have enough training for construction workers. Can we please encourage young people to do apprenticeships instead of Mickey Mouse degrees? And the Michael O'Leary support continues. Michael O'Leary pays his taxes in Ireland. What other Irish billionaire pays their taxes here? Not one, I'd say.
Michael O'Leary flat out texting in this morning.
And you know, I mean, he also
not,
does.
They're not wrong, though. Like, I mean,
but do you know, he also does. In his own area, I think it's in Westmeath, he opens his estate one day a week for, or one day a year for all the locals to come and enjoy it.
And he's a farmer, of course.
My estate one day a year. Coming back after this break. During the break, Valerie Cox was pointing out that Gabia Gadavascacha has done a detailed analysis of the runners and riders and potential candidates for the Live Live and job and completely ignored me in every way, shape.
Do you want it?
I want to be able to say, look, somebody wants me, Gabia. That's all I want.
That's not an answer, by the way.
Colm, we were talking before the break, Bono getting called a liar and an idiot by Elon Musk. This is because Bono called out the damage that has been done around the world by the dissolution of US aid. From your days back in Amnesty, you would undoubtedly have an insight into this. Presumably it is impossible to dissolve one of the world's largest aid organisations and not have immediate huge impact on people's lives.
Massive impact. I mean, and across so many different areas. I mean, the global development infrastructure is retracting and retrenching massively. I mean, everything from humanitarian development organizations to things like, you know, the UN High Commission for Refugees, which has lost 40% of its funding as a result of the US aid cuts. So organizations like IOM, the International Organization for Migration, the UN High Commission for Refugees, these are now facing huge funding crisis because the US was such a significant funder. Because the US used its position here, both in terms of having an impact on the world, but also growing and developing US soft power, which was huge, right? So it's having a devastating impact. But I mean, you know, Bono on Joe Rogan, which was something I never thought I'd hear myself say, Bono on Joe Rogan, God knows, maybe he thinks him speaking to the manosphere is going to turn that, all of that around. I don't see that happening somehow. He was referring to academic research from Boston College, I believe, really credible academic research that said that almost 100,000 adults and 200,000 children have died, not will die, have died already as a result of US aid cuts. Musk called him an idiot and said that absolutely nobody has died, which is patent nonsense. You know, the withdrawal of significant humanitarian interventions, everything from food aid to desperate communities who rely entirely on food aid, to medical aid and health services, is having a huge impact. And indeed, hundreds of thousands of people are dying. What's even, I think, more interesting to see about, not more interesting, but remarkable about how all of this is playing out is the animosity now between Musk and other elements of the MAGA movement. Like Steve Bannon and himself clearly despise each other. But, you know, Bannon is quoted in the Sunday Times today in a piece by Katie Bowles, where she says that, where Bannon says, "We're in a crisis. We have to start acting like adults, and we can't depend on people with the maturity of 11-year-olds to lead us out of this." I think he's referring to Musk. It seems to me that the biggest problem we have with the US administration at the moment is that there's an awful lot of people, including its president, who don't seem to have the emotional maturity of 11-year-olds.
But even that appearance of Musk in the Oval Office during the week, where he was there with a black eye, he claims because he told his 5-year-old son to punch him
in the face. Yeah.
Wearing a Godfather Doge Father t-shirt and behaving very strangely while having to deny that he's on ketamine. How do we end up here?
The New York Times story about his ketamine use and reports that are all across the newspapers today, for instance, that he was using so much ketamine that he was developing significant bladder issues as a consequence of that. So essentially, if we're to believe what's there, we have a ketamine-addled egomaniac making decisions that are wiping out significant parts of US social infrastructure and having a huge impact on the lives of people in the US, but also the lives of people globally. How did we get here? I mean, it's hard to see how US democracy can turn itself around at this stage. I know that's something we talked about regularly in this room, but it's deeply worrying. I mean, we have idiots and egomaniacs worse than ever in charge of what's meant to be the most powerful office in the world.
Who were elected by a landslide.
Who were elected, well, I wouldn't call it a landslide, but a landslide in terms of the Electoral College, but who were elected, and there's no way of getting out of that, yeah. I mean, it says everything about the depth of polarisation that's happened in the United States, that's part of what's particularly difficult. How does it come back from this place? How does that society find a sense of itself or as any sense of common values or shared values so it can move forward together? Until a society has a level of social cohesion, how can it ever be led, never mind direct itself out of any particular crisis?
But I think if we look at, and I know this is not exactly what we're talking about, but if you look at the context of the Jake Tapper book on Joe Biden and Joe Biden's decline, I mean, there is, like, the Democrats do have massive questions to answer over why they even thought it was a good idea remotely to run Joe Biden, when you could see very clearly that he was not able to even do his job as president, no mind do another 4 years. And I just think it's interesting when you look at how polarized American politics is. I mean, people do look at what Trump is doing and they've elected him and they've re-elected him and they trust him. And then when you look at how his presidencies play out, I mean, every day in the Oval Office is just yet another bizarre circus.
Well, a couple of things on that. First of all, his approval ratings are historically low for a president, right? So I don't know that people do trust him. Mm. And even in the areas where he had significant levels of support on, for instance, the economy and migration before he became president, those approval ratings are collapsing. On Biden and on the Democrats, absolutely, they should be roundly criticised for many of the things that they've done. But I do get really concerned that we seem to somehow, I don't know whether it's for perceptions of balance or something else, we say, well, so Trump is devastating and destroying and tearing asunder US democracy and US institutions, both legal and democratic. But yeah, the Democrats told us that Biden would be all right.
No, but the point is, you know, that the point is that they completely the point is that they put forward a candidate
who shouldn't have been put forward.
But not only, like, they tried to put forward to the public this person who clearly was not able to do their current job, no mind another 4 years of it, and say this is the only alternative that you had.
I agree.
They put in Kamala Harris way too late. And for all the criticism of Trump, like, to be fair, like, it is a two-way street, and that it's Republicans versus Democrats in the US. It's very difficult to get outside of that. Like, what was the alternative, you know?
Well, I'm conscious. Sorry, folks. We have another radio presenter not mentioned in Gabia's list of people who might take over Liveline. Who is?
Would you like the Liveline job, Jess?
Is this the official offer?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Come on, Jess. You'd be great.
I'm too loyal
Jess
here.
Kelly is with us. And the reason Jess Kelly is with us is because she's all geared up to do the women's mini marathon. This is your
second year. So,
what insight have you into it that you didn't have the last time?
That I'm an Egypt. I was deluded last year, and now it's just been confirmed that I'm an Egypt. I was so excited coming into town. You see the branding for the VHI Women's Mini Marathon. I came in on the N11. I saw, you know, the 5K mark, the 6K mark. I was buzzing. And now I need another nervous wee. I'm absolutely petrified. Why did I sign up to this?
Are you setting out to set a personal best? Are you trying to do better than you did the last time?
No, I'm going to try and get the thing done. So my goal was, I'm raising funds for the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. This is my second year raising funds for that organisation. I said it last year and I'll say it again. This is an organisation that I wish didn't need to exist, but it does. And we are reminded constantly of how vital it is and the supports that it gives people who need it. So my goal was to raise €2,000. I'm delighted to say that I've raised €2,100 so far. But if you are listening right now, and rather than buying a coffee, if you want to send that €5 somewhere else, it'll go directly to Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. So you can donate on idonate.ie/runfordrcc. And hopefully that'll get me through.
Well, it's brilliant to see. And it's brilliant to see so many people looking all. There's a sort of a febrile sense to the atmosphere.
There is a buzz in the air.
Still -5% precipitation. You're looking at 19 kilometre an hour winds and partly cloudy. That's not bad running conditions.
Okay, I'll take that. I'll take what I can get.
And you feel great once it's over.
Well, that's it. The smoke factor from last year carried me through until about 3 hours ago. So I'm hoping that the smoke factor this year will carry me through to next year.
I will think of you while I'm on my couch this afternoon.
You're such a wagon wheel. Thanks, Anton.
Best of luck, Jess. Now, to the Liveline speculation. This is in the Sunday Independent. Runners and riders, top of the pile, Katie Hannan.
Yeah, well,
and by the way, I should say we are in the presence of a former Liveline presenter, of course.
Well, one summer I did it, yes. Seriously,
did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed doing it, but I would have reservations about it. I mean, you think about you doing it this full time, 5 days a week. Joe Duffy did it for years and years and years. You are talking to everybody with a whinge in Ireland. Some legitimate whinge.
Paid handsomely first.
Some not. Never mind the pay. You've got to sit in that studio every day for 5 days a week. And you can't be rude to people either. I mean, you can't tell them you're in the wrong, go get stuffed, you know, jog on. You can't do things like that. You're an RTÉ presenter and you have to be very polite. And this is one of the reasons I don't think Anton would want it. Because I can't see Anton.
I can't be polite 5 days a week.
Anton, you wouldn't be able to spend the rest of your life or your broadcasting career being polite to people. That just wouldn't work. And these suggestions you have here, Gabby, I would take issue with several of them. First of all, Tommy Tiernan is not going to get it. What do you think RTÉ is doing?
How do you know?
Because I'll tell you why. RTÉ is already appointing comedians all over the place. We've Patrick Keilty doing the Late Late Show.
Yeah.
We've Oliver Callan doing the morning show.
Well, there you go.
And we don't need Tommy Tiernan doing live
just,
line.
Just to check though, now. Valerie, aren't both Tommy Tiernan and Oliver Callan, haven't both Patrick Keilty and Oliver Callan increased the ratings for both of those shows?
I'm not suggesting they haven't.
Yeah, but I mean, but therefore, RTÉ might well want to keep
the comedian
precedence. Joe Duffy's. Now, Dáithí O'Shea, why would he want it? He's got the afternoon show and the Rose of Tralee. He'd have to give up something. I'm sure
he will give up the afternoon show because he'll be doing live line. And again, paid handsomely
They won't be paid at the level that...
Here's your bag of money.
Well, I'm sketchy on the cap because the cap has been declared to be 250,000 because nobody gets paid more than the DG.
Yeah.
But the DG's on 337.
Yeah.
So there seems to be some wiggle room in there. 334 wouldn't be bad for doing live.
If somebody's already doing
Are you negotiating your salary, Anton?
If somebody's already doing a very good job in RTÉ with a high listenership, for example, Dáithí, they're not going to move him. I think you're right that the front runner is Katie Hannon. But again, whether she would want it or not. I've also heard a rumour.
Hang on, is this the word of the public?
It's just under her name.
Yeah.
But I think she's probably the outstanding candidate. But I've also heard a rumour that they're going to change the format of Liveline and make it a bit different and, you know, liven it up, bring it up to date. And that would probably be a very good idea. And Katie would probably suit that form.
Can I tentatively raise a possibility that following Joe is the world's greatest poison chalice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Liveline is Joe Duffy. I mean, I think when you look at the really high listenership numbers, like, it's really successful. And he's done it for 30 years and he makes the money that he makes because it's Joe and you ring in and it's the whole thing of talk to Joe. You've got a problem.
But it's also one of the most difficult gigs in Irish radio. You have to foment anger. You have to tiptoe around libel in issues that are breaking around you where people are brought in to complain. It is a defamation nightmare. He does it superbly and he's generated listenership out the door for that show. Who's going to follow him?
And like he, from a broader social perspective, he has had extraordinary impact at particular points, right? Mm-hmm. We can snoot our noses a little
cystic fibrosis.
At cystic fibrosis, if you look at institutional abuse, if you look at cleric, if you look at how he dealt with those issues and how Liveline dealt with those issues, he was phenomenal.
And
the program was
about sex and contraception.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, equally, I do worry a little bit about the idea that they're going to change it up and make it more interesting. In the context of the kind of divisive nonsense that we're living with in the clip-bake environment. What are they going to do? Have, like, I don't know, live on-air boxing matches or something?
Yeah. But Joe has been very much a force for change, as you say.
Been brilliant.
I mean, he's taken on all of these big issues and stuck with them. Mm. But I still think, you know, it's a very difficult job.
But it's
and
also...
I know you're begrudging the money now, Gabby. But
listen, I think you're paid to do the job and you do the job. Like, how hard is it to be nice to people?
Some jobs you need to be paid a lot more for.
Look, if Michael O'Leary is getting 100 million, come on, what's the going rate for life?
That the taxpayer is paying for in a little river of 160 euros. Also, Liveline is really effective in that. I mean, 9 times out of 10, if you tune into Liveline, it's somebody who's having an issue with something and it's to do with a particular company. If they're on Liveline, they usually ring up and say, we'll refund all the money, don't worry about it. And it's a win for that person. And I think that's kind of what journalism is for.
I mean, personally would love to see Anton get it because I'd love to see Anton's reaction.
We'll be on.
The last time I happened to tune into Liveline when I was driving somewhere, there was a very heated debate happening about the obscenity of
razors, women's razors, and the adverts used to advertise women razors, and whether or not they showed too
right
much of the pubis,
street.
And whether that was
perfect.
And I'm just trying to imagine Anton talking to Mary from I don't know, Balting, wherever.
On that note,
I would actually pay a little bit extra just to sense Anton's discomfort in that given situation.
Will you do another article next week?
We are moving on. Colm O'Gorman, Valerie Cox, Kavya Gadifuscatcha, thank you so much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.